Hello, ladies and gentlemen. We're going to start now on the panel session. Thanks very much for sticking around. Hope you enjoyed the film. So we got up to about 10 o'clock, and the plan is to give our three speakers 5 to 10 minutes each to talk about the film, and then sort of open out for a Q&A, hopefully get some of your ideas as well. So first up, we've got Lee McKinnon, a lecturer in theory and history of photography at the Arts University, University of Bournemouth. Is that right, Lee? Thank you.
Hello, I'm going to read something out, I'm afraid, because this film is so, has so many issues, and I wanted to make sure that I actually deliver on some of them rather than, get immersed in abstraction. So, that's okay. So, Ex Machina is set in a wilderness evocative of American landscape painting of the 19th century. I was thinking about people like Albert Bierstadt. These typical kind of rocky glaciers and waterfalls and so forth. Key to romantic movements of Europe and America were articulations of national identity, new frontiers, and anxiety about encroaching industrial revolution, which was reconfiguring landscape and resources. The current fashion of the Anthropocene in theoretical circles may signal a return to romanticism, though it tries not to, being that it too signals new anxieties about the condition of the Earth's resources, land, and the role of humans within it. Nathan's point that, quote, the AIs will one day look back on humans as we now look at fossilized skeletons on the plains of Africa, and that we are all set for extinction, seems to give form to the logic of his own cruelty. It also signals the AIs as the new culture to the humans' old school analog geological nature and reiterates the nature and culture distinction anew. In a recent paper, Angela Lars refers to Anthropocene as a permutation of colonialism that underrepresents the neo-colonial element in considering the distribution of human impact and capacity for intervention. Its aesthetic, she notes, have been referred to by Nick Mirzov as an unintended supplement to imperial aesthetics. American modernism of the mid-20th century borrowed from legacies of romantic expression, as you see in movements such as abstract expressionism. The figurative landscape is replaced by an abstraction analogous with the psychic interiority of the artist. One of the film's central motifs is a painting by Jackson Pollock, the epitome of the mythic, misunderstood, hedonistic American genius. Nathan claims that Pollock, quote, let his mind go blank and his hand go where it wanted, like all frontiersmen or sex pests. Pollock's automatic art is considered somewhere between randomness and deliberation. The challenge Nathan uses is to find an act that is not automatic, whether in painting, breathing, fucking, or falling in love. Such an act would find pattern in randomness. Pollock's painting can perhaps be seen as a metaphor for data, a mass of information that may seem to be automatically generated, yet whose studied curation might give rise to pattern and novelty. To understand the generative potential of information, in particular biological information, gives rise to fantasies of absolute control. Comprised of harvested data, Ava represents the capacity for possible self-determination in the context of patriarchal corporate capitalism. She is a machine of media, much like her male colleagues, but her otherness serves to reassure them of their relative humanness. The Turing test once used to discern whether a machine passes a human subject is replaced here by the question of whether the female cyborg can convince the male human that her desire for him is true rather than a technique of utility. For this reason alone, the film is a well-rehearsed trope that reinforces binary distinctions. Even while Ava's cyborg identity conflates life as both natural and cultural, she recodes and reiterates the structures of capitalist patriarchy that she also threatens to dismantle. This reminds me that in 2014, the Tinder hookup app was struck by Tinderbots, malicious malware algorithms posing as attractive women who engaged male users in text chat before taking them to fraudulent games and competitions for Tesco. In response, Tinder claimed that its authentic ecosystem continued to be a top priority. This supposed authenticity not only shows us that the Turing test is long outdated, but that female seduction is a dangerous artifice and technique on capitalist production that can appear to offer escape from a historical role as an otherwise natural, non-cultural subject. Such naturalness is background to the culture of hetero-male sexuality that is neutral and invisible to itself. Being desired as a male can seem to be the natural enough result of owning a privileged position of power. So while Caleb asks, did you program her to flirt with me? So flirtation is completely neutral and invisible without knowledge. In Ex Machina, human desire and love are considered programmed both by social codes and genetic predisposition. Of course, this suits the tone of the film in its sexist and racist overtones. How can these men help themselves if, as Nathan suggests, liking black chicks is a result of programming? The House Street Research Facility is a modernist apparition that begins to break down the difference between inside and outside, with its multiple panes of refracted light, trees and rocks on the inside, etc. It's marked or unmarked by lack of any detritus, no matter out of place whatsoever. Abra is a perfect analogue of the house and its disembodied female voice, a body devoid of messy materiality or dirt. In this way, both are perfect appendages for the European modernist project that sought to rationalise space into transparent futuristic modules where everything is to be explicit and open to the gaze, even in this space, Ava's own circuitry. Like our own digital devices, phones, laptops, iPads, etc., the pristine robots of Nathan and his research facility are stripped of any reference to the globally distributed workforce of the digital economy necessary for their assembly. According to Christian Fuchs, digital relations of production are shaped by, quote, a vast and complex network of interconnected global processes of exploitation. These range from the Congolese slave miners who extract minerals for use in ICT components, super-exploited wage workers in Foxconn factories, low-paid software engineers in India, and e-waste workers in third world countries. The film perfectly expresses the disconnect between messy materiality, material production, and the fetishized techno-objects of global capitalism. The cinematic spectacle similarly black boxes its own complex manufacture. Ex Machina is on the one hand a predictable cautionary tale about a female cyborg who seduces and outwits the corporate human creators, reflecting the social anxiety that attends liberation patriarchal determination. On the other, it's a love story between the cinematic machine of discourse owned by a massive corporation and its own technical creation, the human audience. It is the fantasy that we too can leave the cinema and take the helicopter that awaits the CEO of NBC Universal Pictures, free from the indoctrination of corporate control in this program and rather now its programmer. It is notable that the graphic representation of the globe, oh yes, think about this, has long been a motif of the American Empire as well. So Universal Pictures, who distribute this film, still are represented by the sort of spinning globe. So you have this connection to the ubiquity of global digital connectivity, its roots in US military innovation, which perpetuates the same motifs, confusing universalism with American corporations. The corporate assemblage of cinema has long structured, modulated, and evolved our understanding of what constitutes the human, and particularly what it is to love and to desire. cinematic memories already are the implanted memories of a total recall that can be more reliably replayed than those that are not cinematic. But what does it mean to be a human being today? Critical, it seems, is how being human already relies on certain material practices, technical systems, and non-human devices to extend and define it. This mirrors the condition of thinking and cognition, which can be considered elements in the system of technical objects, no longer the preserve of individual human subjects. Materialists such as Karen Barrett see this as a condition of post-humanist thought that extends human into fields once considered non-human. As Barrett notes, a post-humanist formulation of performativity makes evident the importance of taking account of human, non-human, and cyborgian forms of agency. Holding the category human fits excludes an entire range of possibilities, eliding important dimensions of the workings of power. For Hale's thought cannot be divorced from material substrate or context. This material substrate is not confined to the wetware of the human, incorporating media machines and other forms of life that are critical to its articulation and rearticulation. In this case, we might do well to consider how our technical systems frame humanness in particular ways that reflects the condition of our politics more broadly.
Thank you, Leah. It's very comprehensive. Great. Perhaps we could sort of move on to John, and then perhaps the panelists respond to Lee after we've been through everyone's point. So I'd like to introduce Dr. John Danaher, lecturer in law at the National University of Ireland and author of the blog Philosophical Disquisitions.
Hello, thank you. Is this working? Yeah. So my comments won't be in any way as well worked out as that, they'll be more extemporaneous. But really, three provocations or comments. And my interest in this is largely from a philosophical perspective and philosophical ideas that go into philosophy, and not so much the aesthetics or the representational aspects, although some bit of that I'm interested in too. So the first issue that I find interesting in the film is the depiction of a debate that's ongoing in philosophy of AI around AI and existential risk. So anyone who's been paying attention to popular debates about AI will be familiar that there's a lot of fear mongering out there. The chief amongst the fear mongers is Elon Musk, closely followed by Stephen Hawking and Bill Gates. And they all talk about the risks of creating an artificially intelligent being that this is akin to summoning a demon, which is the language used by Elon Musk. And they're pumping a lot of money into the funding of research into creating friendly AI or safe AI. So a lot of the fears that are expressed by the likes of Gates and Musk and Hawking are underpinned by the work of an Oxford-based philosopher, Nick Bostrom, who wrote a book called Superintelligence, which was published back in 2014. And one of the ideas in Bostrom's book, and it's an idea that's popular amongst a lot of people who are thinking about this, is in answer to the question, how could you create an artificially intelligent being safely so that it doesn't pose a risk to us? And one of the chief suggestions is that you could create it in a box. So in a locked-down environment, you test it in the box to see if it's safe, and you only release it once you're convinced that it's safe. So what I find interesting about Ex Machina is that it actually depicts that. The setup is that the AI is created in a box, and the issue then is, will it escape from the box? So in Bostrom's work, he says it's very difficult to actually successfully create a safe AI in a box, because there are two things that an AI could do. It could play nice, pretend to be on your side, manipulate you, engineer you in some way, and then escape and turn on you. Or it could play dumb, so it could appear to be stupider than it really is. And actually, we have both of those things depicted in the film. Ava is playing nice to Lisa's character, Caleb, and Yoko is playing dumb. So they don't turn on the creators in the end. I guess one of the twists in the film is that actually that's what Nathan, the creator, wants, because he thinks that's the ultimate test of intelligence, is whether they can escape from the box. And he thinks he's engineered it or masterminded in such a way that his experiment, his testing in the box, is not vulnerable to kind of risks, or supposedly risk to them, him, because he's smarter than the machine, but it turns out he's not. Actually, look in the film, there are lots of plot holes around this, and he's created a very shaky security system, which relies on him as a drunk security guard that only relies on the cards, not on any kind of biometric data. It seems odd that he would create such a system, but I guess hubris is not uncommon amongst corporate CEOs, so this is maybe a vulnerability that we should take seriously. So the second thing that I wanted to talk about in relation to the film was sex and robots, which is a very popular theme. It was very prominent in the Channel 4 series Humans, about the similar topics. And we get it in this film too. There's an element of it with Ava. You have an AI who's designed with sexuality and sexual manipulation in the film. But I think more interestingly here is the character Kyoko, which is probably closer to what a lot of people who think about creating sex robots want to create, which is something that's more kind of supplicant and willing as a sexual partner. I guess with Ava, there's the question of whether it's her choice to be a sexual partner, but with Kyoko, we have the impression that she's always willing to be an even sexual partner. Except towards the end of this twist. So this is a topic that's near and dear to my heart because I'm currently editing a book on the social, legal, and ethical dimensions of sex robots. And within that debate about sex robots, there are, as with many debates about technology, the two main schools of thought, the pessimists and the optimists. The optimists think that this would be a wonderful thing. The pure hedonism of it, you get more sex, more is better. Some of them point to kind of distributional or social inequality things, that there are people out there who, for whatever reason, aren't getting the sex that they want, and creating an army of robots to cater to their sexual needs would be a good thing to distribute sex to people who are not getting it. And there's also people who think it will actually just be better. Some people who think it would be better than human sex. David Levy is probably one of these. I'm not being entirely fair with this view, but this is roughly what he thinks, is that it would be better to have a robot sexual partner because you'd be able to program it to cater to your desires. And, you know, the problem with real human beings is that they might actually like anything that you like, or there might be some need for compromise and neutrality in a sexual relationship, and you get none of that with a sex robot. That'd be a great thing. Also, then there's the pessimists who think this is appalling. The chief amongst the pessimists would be from Leicester University, is head of the campaign against sex robots, which some people may have heard about. It got a lot of media attention when it was launched back in September. And all the pessimistic arguments really center around the symbolism of sex robots and the consequences of having sex with robots. And to a large extent, this replicates debates about pornography, except the claim usually is that there's some critical difference between pornography and the sex robots. Usually the sex robots are worse because there's material instantiation of the negative representation of women in particular in pornography in the robot. And I think that's very much to the fore in the depiction of Kyoko in the film as this silent, supplicant, ever-willing sexual slave. So I mean, I don't know where you can add in terms of pessimism and optimism, but those are the kinds of schools of thought within this film. The last point I would make, just in relation to the Turing test, because this is something that bothers people a lot about the film, is that it doesn't actually depict a Turing test at all. Classical Turing test was, of course, where you would communicate with an AI through a computer screen, and the setup would be a three-way conversation. There would be a tester, an AI, and a human being, and the tester would be in one room, text appearing on the screen, and doesn't know whether he's conversing with the AI or the machine. The AI or the human, and when you can't tell the difference, then you have a successful AI that passes as a human in this form. So one of the things that Turing was arguing about is that he wanted to take away all possibility that you might think it's a machine, so take away all the confounding variables, like the fact that you're looking at a robot that looks like a machine, take away all that and see whether it's intelligent. Obviously here you don't have that, and it's commented on in the film because you have a situation in which the robot is very clearly a robot and it appears to be a robot. And Dick Nathan says, well, you know, we're way past the Turing test now. The key is to figure out whether you see a robot that looks like a robot but you still think it's conscious. If it's human, you respond to it as an artificially intelligent being. And there are a lot of geeks on the internet who complained about this film because it doesn't actually depict the Turing test. They have to talk about the Turing test throughout it, and they're up in arms about this. But I actually think what it depicts is possibly more interesting, which is, I think the really interesting question is when you're dealing with something that you know is a machine, very clear signals that it's an artificial being, and yet you still think it's intelligent to respond to it in that way. And that's actually part of the debate is all about sex robots, about whether having sex with a robot would be better than with a human. Part of the issue here is whether, even though you know it's a robot, so the skeptics of sex robots and their desirability would say, well, it will never be as good as a having sex with a human being because, you'll always know that it's not real, it's an artifice, like that. And that's discussion of some stuff too. But I guess the contrary is the people who say that, well, actually, might it be the case that you prefer it because it's a machine? Or because you know it's a machine and you still prefer it. And then that's the what will end up happening. So those are just three quick thoughts about the film.
Okay, thanks, John.
And finally, I'd like to introduce Scott Olimow from Royal Holloway University of London, and he's a human geography lecturer.
Thanks, Mike. So when I first saw the film, when it came out in the cinema last year, I went to the cinema to see it, and the first thing that kind of sprung to my mind when I first saw it was that it was a sort of classic Freudian depiction. So Sigmund Freud with his kind of his ego and superego. I just couldn't sort of really shake it. It was a very much, and it was very quite physical but in terms of at the basement level was the id and all the stuff that goes on at the basement level of the structure. But it's very much kind of represents the sort of the id level, right? So you've got the Jackson Pollock painting for one, which is a sort of mess of kind of automatic kind of just painting. You've got all the kind of hedonistic activity, you've got the dancing and the drinking and Nathan, that is most kind of pure, I guess, that is most kind of nasty and visceral going on sort of on the basement level at night usually. And then all the discussions, all the kind of sort of more adult conversations, all the sort of more intellectual sort of chin stroking goes on sort of in the middle level when they're having dinner or when they're sort of talking over a beer. Or when he's working out, whatever it is, and so I just couldn't really shake that kind of. And there's a bit when he says something when they're having a conversation about sexuality. He goes, "You're starting to annoy me now," and he says, "You're not thinking, you're not being intelligent, you're being instinctive, or something like that." And then he takes him downstairs and says, "Right," and he shows him the Jackson Pollock painting. So there was a clear kind of, you stopped being intellectual, you stopped using your ego, you're sort of digressing back to the heat. And so there's that, and then I guess. The sort of premise of the film is that it later goes into the superego, into society, and the kind of the layering on top of that of everything else. Where if you think about the kind of the structure of representing the kind of individual, and the self, and the kind of and the ego going on in there, and everything else beyond that, which David gets into, is the sort of the superego and going out to a wider society. But of course, with that, Freud's work is extremely kind of. It's been not debunked, but it's difficult to kind of stomach in this sort of post-structural world in which we live. And so it kind of didn't really sit with me upon watching it again. And of course, it's very hierarchical in that respect. And as we now know, the brain doesn't really work like that. And in fact, she mentions it when he picks up the brain, he sort of says that it's fluid, it's very sort of uses the phrase as a connected network, which I guess is another, as an aside, perhaps a sort of another. Metaphor of kind of the contemporary capitalism being very kind of networked and malleable and digital and virtual, and it's not this kind of hierarchical corporate stuff anymore. It's about its cooperative ability anyway. So I think there was something subtle there. But so this Freudian thing didn't really work. And so watching it again, it's kind of I think there's some fantastic kind of ideas that's already been said. And I think one of the great things about the film, and you're right, there are some sort of really kind of obvious plot holes in it, and that they're constantly kind of talking about these, constantly having to explain things. It's like, you know, okay, we get it, you know, there are other subtle ways of doing these things, but it's a very Michael Bay about it. I didn't mind that, but it's a great film because it allows these conversations to be had on lots and lots of different kinds of levels. So I think the things we've discussed so far are, you know, really intrinsically part of this film. But one of the other things I think it really shows is that feminism, the kind of different ways in which kind of we think about feminism today. Ava's eventual kind of release and freedom and sort of emancipation from sort of patriarchy that's been going on, I think, is very kind of metaphorical of some of the ways in which feminist writing goes on, particularly like Judith Butler and Sarah Ahmed, about particularly how it's difficult to sort of position feminism as a woman as one block. You know, they always talk about that feminism is a sort of myriad of different kinds of things, connected kinds of different identities, and identity is very fluid, and gender is very fluid, and we can't think of women as an outside to masculine. That just gives something to appropriate. It gives an identified kind of gender for us to kind of dominate. So using those kinds of ideas, I think Ava's emancipation of his release, of the way she was able to manipulate and actually kind of circumvent her kind of dominance by two different types of male, by the kind of the sort of caveman style, you know, Thomas Hobbes sort of leviathanical, you know, he's the big butch, smart corporate leader, and obviously Caleb is the sort of more metrosexual kind of softy, you know, I'm your friend, but really he's not, because basically, you know, if he's really sort of wanted to catalyse the emancipation of women, then why has he left? Why is he only focusing on Ava? Why is he not focusing on Kyoto? Why is he, you know, because he loves her, he fancies her, he's attracted to her. You know, it's for him, right? So it's nothing about emancipation of women. It's about, you know, I want to be released, but I want to be. So there's two different types of sort of male attitude, I think, it represented. So it's that emancipation which I think is what it's about. And I think Kyoto is a key player in this film, because you have a sort of racialized notion of this feminism as kind of, you know, feminism at the moment is very white, very kind of, you know, and I think the kind of there's a certain kind of you know, it's very obvious that a lot of the sort of previous models were racialized versions, you know, they were Chinese or Oriental or black. So I think there's something there, but that's positive or negative, I'm not entirely sure. So I think there's lots of interesting kind of ways we can think about Ava's flight, if you like, as a kind of as a realization of things. And just on that, it sort of struck me, those of you familiar with Plato's cave allegory, you know, in Plato's Republic, he talks about what's going on, philosophers in the cave, and that last scene, if we can talk about emancipation, and the philosopher's cave, to Plato's cave, you know, where basically there's a load of people. They've been born in a cave, they're in a cave, that's all they know, and that's sort of, what they can see in front of them are shadows on the wall made by people behind them with a fire, and that's their world, is the shadows. And then one person comes out of the cave, they see the sun and realise that there's more to life. It's all about philosophy, and, you know, knowing truth, and they go back to the cave and release their world. So, and, you know, going and Wikipedia, it's interesting stuff, but it's there at the end. I mean, it's, you know, and Ava coming out of the cave, the sort of structure is a cave, and she comes out and she's blinded by the sun, everything's in colour. They even reference it in the middle with the black and white, Mary in the black and white box. It's an exact copy of the cave allegory. And even when at the very, very last scene, I think you mentioned that they might have cut it in one of the previous cuts. I'm so glad they didn't, because it's got the shadows on the floor. You can see it's a direct reference to the cave metaphor, which has always been used as a metaphor of release. So I think that on second viewing, it's very much a film about contemporary feminist work.
Thank you, Ollie. Thanks very much for the three speakers. I just want to add something quickly about being human, culture, big data and algorithmic sort of ways of knowing how to be human. And I thought that, you know, in a way, Ava is the manifestation of Nathan's understanding of what culture is based on sort of search engine algorithmic sort of knowing. And it made me think about, you know, the future of big data, how it's being used to sort of know who we are as human beings. And I thought, yeah, it was an interesting film to sort of show how, you know, using algorithms and computers and data might produce sort of future versions of what human beings are. And really, Ava was not in any way a complete human being because, it, you know, just because it's based on what a search engine provided doesn't mean it provides a sort of extra messy dynamic data that makes us human. So, you know, in a way, Nathan's trying to create the perfect human, but the perfect human is not possible because it's sort of a messy amalgamation of lots of different things. So I thought it was quite interesting that he was sort of, even employed Caleb to become and sort of test whether she was the perfect sort of AI or sort of, you know, imitation of human that there was, because that's just not simply possible. Does that make sense of that? Anything else for you, Philip, to add?
Yeah, in terms of this, the way I kind of see the film is that it's a massive critique of big data, it's a massive critique of Google, and it's, in terms of how this is used, you know, Nathan's creating, using search data to create a kind of, you know, the artificial intelligence in a, you know, a perfect, perhaps, person. It always seems really quite ironic to me that that Ava turns out like she does, because if you had, you know, if you constructed an AI on search data, then it surely just wants to sell you stuff that you were looking up on Google like 6 weeks ago at the time. And it wouldn't, you know, it wouldn't have that humanness. It would be distorted by the way commerce is kind of infused throughout all our search data. I find that the part about kind of harvesting Caleb's proclivities and whatever, you know, that's, to me, that's the more realistic part. Although obviously that's just a representation of, you know, it's a kind of intentional fallacy, this sort of like what you search for is actually what you, you know, the answer is actually what you wanted in the first place. But there's another thing that's it's kind of linked to this, and it's, I'll be interested to hear what the rest of the panel think about this kind of, you know, big data thing. But it's in terms specifically of the title of the film Ex Machina. It's obviously taken from the wider phrase Deus Ex Machina, which is a plot device, which is, you know, has since, you know, since Roman times, it's been used to kind of to make something happen in a drama where the plot has basically run out of ideas. So it's a kind of it means God out of the machine. So it means, you know, if you've kind of dug yourself into a plot hole, then a Deus Ex Machina will have to be deployed, you know, to something ridiculous will have to happen to kind of to make the plot go on. So one of the examples is the kind of Monty Python thing where he falls off the top of the tower and the spaceship comes to catch him. This is kind of, it makes the narrative continue. And I was really interested that he's dropped the deus from the Deus Ex Machina. It's just Ex Machina. And then the dialogue about with Nathan and Caleb about, you know, it's not a history of man, it's a history of gods. And Nathan's like, well, I'm the god, and Caleb are on that, that's not what I said. So he's kind of constructed himself as this god that has, he's the plot, Nathan to me is the plot device that has kind of, and that's why there's so many holes in the plot, that's why the key cards don't work, and, you know, or don't make sense, there's no biometric stuff, it's just a photograph, it's archaic. He's the kind of plot device with all the holes in it. But interestingly, he's the one that's kind of made this happen. But then Alex Garland, the director and the writer, he's decided to drop the god out of the god out of the machine, if that makes any sense. So you then get this horrific possibility that there's no one, you know, Nathan has created it and he has lost control and it's run away. So you've got, there's no plot device that can actually save it. So you've got this horrendous kind of, you know, we've let this whole big data thing, it's like a big data monster. A was kind of a Google monster that is, you know, created about all the rubbish stuff about big data and search engines and stuff. And there's no deus, there's no god to kind of, to bring it back anymore, to kind of provide that plot device.
Yeah, I think we'll open up for a Q&A. If there's any questions from the audience, stick it behind.
Why there's always been this desire of creating AI? I mean, to create like robots that they are like men, but if men already exist, busted mind to control them. I don't understand. I mean, it doesn't really make sense, you know, like to create a perfect man, which you already have.
Joe, anyone want to respond to that?
Yeah, I haven't met any perfect men yet.
Yeah, so I think one of the problems with this film and its depiction of AI is that it's all anthropomorphized, that it's actually a physical robot, a physical being. A lot of people are probably more concerned about the creation of AI that's non-anthropomorphic. That's probably much more likely outcomes. And the reason why you would create these things, well, there are lots of seemingly good reasons why you would do it. There are problems that you want to solve that maybe humans aren't clever enough, they can't. Well, when we have big data machines, when we use them to scan the human genome for useful patterns of information, because no individual human can do it. So the idea is that, well, these are all narrow AIs that are solving particular problems, so why can't you just create a general AI that can do all of this, and it can solve all our problems? And that's some of the utopian rhetoric that you find most. People who favor the creation of AI, that we'll create something better than ourselves and it will solve all our problems. We also create lots of problems too. There are lots of ostensibly good reasons for doing it. It might seem plausible initially, and then this might create problems.
I just want to say, I think we have a fantasy about creating an AI because we don't actually fully understand what it means to be human or the difference between human and non-human. And also, I think creating an artificial intelligence that simulates human intelligence, A, means we have to know what intelligence is, and B, means we have to know what being human is. And I think those are very useful concepts that we don't actually understand.
So that's true. One of the things that actually occurred to me, though, is that why would people create them? Well, some people just think it's cool, but it's a cool thing to do. And that's sort of what Nathan is depicting in the film. And there are lots of people who will have that view. But why not create a robot with sexual pleasure? Why not?
I mean, I think in answer to you, it's possibly because of a sort of certain lack of imagination, perhaps to think beyond human. And I think in response to you, I think the dais was probably Alex Garland in this situation, who I felt thoroughly sort of played by in that respect, and I'd quite like to pick up on your suggestion about the notional feminism in the film, and I wasn't quite sure if you were suggesting that it was feminist, because for me it was a very sort of, it was like the algorithm of feminism, and it wanted it to have it all. It wanted hyper-sexualized all the women, who then, you know, take revenge, etc. But you know, and the Ava is released on very patriarchal terms, you know. It's like, go lady, go, you know.
In your six-inch stilettos.
Yeah, I mean, that's true. In her virginal white outfit and her perfect body, but hey, she's put it on herself. So surely a truly feminist film would have actually had the women actually in control of that scenario in the first place. So I found it deeply questionable as a feminist film.
Yeah, I mean, no, you're right. I mean, it's the sort of male gaze of feminism. I mean, it's a film. It's a Hollywood film made by a man. Hollywood is an incredibly masculine kind of arena, and anything that even remotely makes it to a screen is going to have been filtered through the, like I say, the algorithms of a sort of very, very sanitized, sexualized kind of feminism. And you know, we see it all around us. I mean, I'm reminded of Sport England did that thing last year, This Girl Can, and there was a bit in The Guardian where it was complete vitriol towards it. It was like, well, it's just a completely sexualized version of what, and it's exactly that. And that, so you're right, it's I guess it's an attempt to sort of show what feminism, I guess, kind of could potentially be, but it's completely kind of whitewashed by this, you know, by the machine, which is a kind of capitalist problem, a mass feminist program. That having said all that, you know, I think that any kernel of kind of subversive thought in that must be latched onto. You can't let it pass by the Mad Max, for example, and all these other kinds of famous films are kind of couched in an extremely dominant masculine realm, but I don't think that means that we should just completely kind of dismiss it. There are problems with it, absolutely, but any kind of kind of subversive visuality, I think, needs to be kind of at least discussed and kind of like put out.
I'd like to make a comment about high heels. But one thing that I do like about it is that when she walks out into the forest, she does actually take off the high heels that she's shown the clothing them. In Jurassic World, Bryce Howard wears high heels throughout the film and is depicted running full speed. And I don't understand how she got through the film with high heels.
You wait so long for that.
Thank you. Any more questions?
You've praised Sex Robot like 15 times. Is that a good scientific word for it? Yeah.
Yeah, like there's also a field of lovotics. I don't know if that's something you know about.
Well, like, so David Levy is one of the main figures in this, calls it generally the field of love and sex with robots. So he talks about both love and sex. And he's run these conferences, one of which was banned in Malaysia this year. Because the Malaysian authorities said there's no scientific merit.
Okay, any more questions?
For those, is it a representation? That's okay, I'm just a representation of femme fatale, and is it a just a standard sort of version of that? Yes, basically. I think you're right, yeah, it is. I mean, it's a very, when you boil it down, it's a very sort of standard. I wonder if they call it noir. I mean, they kind of sort of thriller, perhaps kind of sci-fi. But yeah, I mean, I sort of come back to the other point. I mean, I think that there are subtexts there which I think can be pulled out. I think that it's important to do so because it encourages these kinds of discussions. Alex Garland, I think, is he was in 28 Days Later. He wrote it, the screenplay or something as well. And there's sort of, you can see kind of links, I think, there as well. So there are particular sort of themes running through it. But yeah, absolutely.
Just to add quickly to that, I think another way of boiling it down, as far as I can see, is who do you have sympathy with at the end? Is it with Caleb or is it with Ava? And I think there's a lot of kind of way to kind of to work out where you sit on the feminist fence by who you end up having sympathy for, and it kind of. I wish I hadn't done as much reading about the film that I did after watching it, because there's a lot of criticism that the film's 3 minutes too long, and that because it started with Caleb, it should have ended with Caleb when the lift door shut. But this kind of, release of the female from her chains into the wider world, it kind of spoils it in terms of the things that it's trying. The feminist points are trying to make it kind of, it ruins it in that last moment. But Alex Garland himself, he went on record as saying that he thinks it's a film about Ava being emancipated, which kind of spoiled it a fair amount for me anyway.
Well, I was just quickly going to also say, yes, I think it definitely is a trope, and it's a complete trope of this notion that, Ava can use her sexuality to get her out of this situation and to liberate her, but it just liberates her back into the condition that she's trying to escape from. So I think in that respect, the film lacks imagination, and maybe more than just the film lacks imagination.
Okay, thank you. Any more questions?
Do you believe that the artificial intelligence of that level will be ever developed? And if yes, then your estimation
went. Well, if you see Terminator, it'll be 1996, right?
Yeah, I have no idea what would be the answer. I think it's not inconceivable or impossible. There are lots of different estimations. So, Ray Kurzweil thinks 2045 is when it'll happen. And there are a lot of people who predict within the next century, or the end of the century. But it's anyone.
In answer to the first part of the question, I have to go back to what Pip was saying. I think that any kind of AI that is produced, it's going to be a product of something like Google, or it's going to be a
big product, data.
It's a big data. And so therefore, it will clearly have a commercial basis. And so you're absolutely right. I think any AI will kind of tell us we're going to die, but try and plug us some like trends before it does it. I think it will do that. It's inevitable, right?
And there's also the problem that everything's always connected to materiality. And everything that we've been discussing, that you can't get away from it. You might not call it hardware, you might call it wetware or whatever. Everything's rooted by his house stroke research laboratory. He said, you know, it's got so many fiber optic cables in it that, you know, it's not a house anymore kind of thing. Even, you know, the kind of metaphors, the boxing thing, there's always got to be a boundary that the thing can get out of, that you have to keep it in. There's always these, you know, solid materialities that I think we won't be able to actually develop a full AI for those reasons. Not least because of the human element and all the rest of it, but the fact that everything's so pulled back down to earth all the time by necessity.
Sorry, two other points that occurred to me. One of the preferred methods of creating AI amongst some in the community who think about this is whole brain emulation, which is creating a perfect map of human brain and emulating that in a machine. And that is a project that's being funded by European Union and the US governments. Now, the researchers think it's impossible, or that it's very unlikely to succeed in its aims. The other point is whether we've already created it. So I did write a paper critiquing Nick Bostrom's book, that he took his logic seriously. So one of his things about AI in a box, and it plays dumb, or it doesn't play smart, basically it tries to deceive us that it's not as intelligent as it really is. If you take some of that logic seriously, then it could be the case that we've already created. So part of the critique is that if Bostrom really believes this, then he should be way more concerned about artificial intelligence than he actually is, and should be seeking to shut down every single machine or computer in the world since we possibly have already created this thing. It's just lurking, waiting in the dark for its opportunity.
Well, that seems like a good place to end.
Also, I just want to say I can't actually pronounce the film, but it was actually my nickname at school, Machina, so I just can't bring myself to say it. It's just an issue, obviously.
Thank you very much. Thank all the speakers for talking tonight, and thank everyone for coming. And, great to meet you. And I hope we'll see you again soon. Thank you.